Good afternoon, Your Honors. My name is Wendell Porterfield, number 5881. I'd like to reserve 5 minutes. I understand this to be self-monitoring.
I'll try to help you, Mr. Porterfield.
Thank you. In 1972, Fred Hibbert owned a parcel of real property in Centerdale on which he commenced development of what became Village Center Association, a condominium. He filed the first declaration in 1972 for Building A, which contained 8 units. In 73, he filed a supplement for an additional 28 units, and in 1974, he filed a supplement for an additional 20 units. The original declaration and the first supplement provided had provisions regarding parking in another building, which was a parking structure that was going to be built by Mr. Hibbert after completion. The whole project was done under the Colorado Condominium Act, which is not nearly as comprehensive and rigorous as the requirements of CAIO today. The association, Mr. Hibbert eventually sold all of the units, and Village Center Association no longer has any interest in that project. In 2011, Village Center Association sued Mr. Hibbert regarding billing for parking. Now, the parking structure is a multi-level structure, and at the western end of the parking structure, there are 4 levels, and at the eastern end, there are 2 levels. In addition to the parking that takes place for Village Center Association in that building, there are commercial units that are maintained and owned by Mr. Hibbert, and he also built a separate condominium on top of that building, which is called Vail Corp. Those really have nothing to do with what brings us here today. To say in 2011, Village Center Association sued Mr. Hibbert, alleging that he had overbilled them for parking costs for a portion of 2008, all of 2009, all of 2010, and a portion of 2011. And the original declaration contained a paragraph 32D, which had 7 categories of costs and expenses which were to be shared proportionally based on the number of parking places. Those included maintenance, cost and expenses of operation, repair, real estate taxes and assessments, improvements, insurance, and what were called other direct and indirect costs incident to the parking structure. As I say, the association sued, alleging that Hibbert had overbilled them.
Mr. Porterfield, let me ask you, when this original declaration was adopted, then is it accurate that there was no parking structure?
That's correct.
Because this is planning.
This was planning.
It was 32. D was what was expected to occur when the parking structure was built.
That's correct.
And then the supplement one, was there a parking structure existing at the time supplement one was added?
I don't believe that there was, but I cannot say with certainty whether it existed or not.
All right. Next question I have is it accurate that not all of the parking spaces are owned and used by Village Center condominium owners?
There were to be 56 parking spaces. Originally, 48 of those were on the lower level, and all 48 were to be used by Village Center, one assigned to each unit. And then there were to be 8 on the second level, 8 of which were assigned to Village Center Association owners. There was a swap that took place over the years, as a result of which 47 of the 48 spaces on the lower level are used by the association, and 9 of the 50 parking spaces on the second level, or the 48 parking spaces on the second level, are used by Village Center.
So there are some other owners of parking spaces other than Village Center condo owners who are paying toward maintenance and some of these other costs and expenses.
That's right. The cost for everything are divvied up by Mr. Hibbert, and he sends out bills to Vail's BCA, and he sends out bills to Vail Corp, and he is the owner of certain parking spaces for the commercial units.
Thank you.
The second supplement, the language in 6D was put in at a time that the parking structure had been substantially completed. And it simply said, had words to the effect that the association would be responsible for maintenance of the lower level. There was no language about the other costs and expenses that had been in paragraph 32D. And there was nothing in the second supplement that said it was meant to replace in its entirety the language of the First Amendment or the Second Amendment.
I have another question, Mr. Porterfield. The second supplement, six, is that A? I think 6A says the association shall be responsible for maintenance of the parking area and goes on. But when looking at the prior iterations of that in the declaration and the first supplement, is there anything that makes the association itself responsible for any of these expenses and costs? Did the association own any of the parking spaces?
The original declaration provided that the costs, the proportional costs and expenses attributable to those parking spaces shall be a common expense and shall be payable to the association monthly in advance. It did not specifically say that Mr. Hibbert would bill the association, but that was the way it was done since the building was built and he started building. The real issue in this case is our belief that the court improperly or incorrectly, I should say, found that this language was unambiguous and that there was no obligation on behalf of the association to pay any of these other six items of cost. And furthermore, the court relied solely on the testimony of a bookkeeper for the association in coming up with its damages in the case. The association put on the testimony of Mr. Schnupp, who was a bookkeeper, who had not worked for the association during the period of time for which damages were sought. But Mr. Schnupp testified that he simply compared invoices for what he thought the Village Center had paid for maintenance with invoices received from Mr. Hibbert. There was no testimony about what each of those invoices was comprised of, whether it was for maintenance, with no definition, even in the declaration or found by the trial court, as to what maintenance was composed of. There was simply a comparison of two sets of bills divided by the number of parking spaces, and the damage model adopted by the court was that the association appeared to be paying less per parking space for whatever it was paying for than what Mr. Hibbert was billing the association for on a per space basis. There was no testimony, there was no finding about what was or what was not included in maintenance. And in fact, the court's only finding with respect to damages was that Mr. Schnupp compared VCA's payment for the lower garage with defendant's invoices for the upper garage. And based upon the disparity in payments, Mr. Schnupp, who was not qualified as an expert witness, determined that VCA had overpaid approximately $14,500. Without knowing, or without some sort of finding as to what maintenance entails, then you can't simply compare cost for the lower level and cost for the upper level. And in fact, the bill that was submitted by VCA included cost for a parking gate, which had been specifically approved by the Village Center Association on the upper level to control traffic in and out. So the court really had, first of all, in breach of contract, have to find that damages were in fact suffered. And there's no way that on this record you can determine that in fact damages were suffered. And then you get to the next point of showing of being able to determine what those damages are. And as the record reflects, originally the court found that there was no showing of any damages, and it directed Mr. Hibbert to provide an accounting. After the accounting was provided, the court determined that it really didn't need the accounting and went back to sort of a relying solely on the testimony of Mr. Schnupp.
You're at 5 minutes, and I have one more quick question. Hopefully won't take up too much of your time. Is it Mr. Hibbert's position that the second supplement 6A now means that the association solely would pay the maintenance of the parking area and the lower level building, and the other owners who are not condominium owners, other owners and users of the parking spaces would not pay toward the maintenance?
I'm not certain that I understand, but no, the owners, the users of the 9 spaces on the second level get billed through the association for all of the costs associated with that building on a per parking space basis. So the position that the association would take is that it would apparently pay to maintain it, whatever that means, whether it means cleaning, whether it means painting, whatever it means, but it would have no responsibility to pay any cost of repairs, any lighting, any insurance on the upper levels, or anything else.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Hibbert. I ate into your rebuttal time a little bit. Thank you. I'm not Mr. Hibbert, I'm sorry, Mr. Porterfield.
Your Honors, my name is Eric Musselman, number 35976, and I'm the attorney for the plaintiff appellee Village Center Association. I'm going to put the cart before the horse before discussing the breach of contract and parking claims. One of the major issues on appeal here is trespass. This trial court, a very busy trial court, found that Mr. Hibbert permitted the impermanent encroachments that were placed on his property in 2004, were completed in 2004.
Did Mr. Hibbert have to know that there was an encroachment on his property? In other words, did he have to be aware of the boundaries and that the property encroached, or the building encroached upon his property?
Yes, Your Honor.
He had to know that. And is there evidence in the record that he did know that?
Yes, there is evidence in the record that he did know that.
Where would we look to for that evidence?
I would first start with Mr. Hibbert's testimony at trial. The second issue that I would look at are the documents that were admitted into evidence that address the correspondence by the parties concerning the work that was being performed. These are very large buildings.
And so that correspondence would reflect that Mr. Hibbert knew that it was going to encroach upon his property?
There's no specific statement where Mr. Hibbert says, I know there's an encroachment, I am permitting it.
Well, how about that? I know there's a boundary and it's going to exceed my boundary. That's okay.
No, there's no writing whatsoever.
So what is the evidence that indicates that he was aware that the encroachment, or that the work would encroach upon his property?
Mr. Hibbert's testimony and my client, Mr. Carpenter's testimony, that at a certain point in time when this improvement project was starting, that the parties stood outside, looked at the property, and had plans out, where my client testified that he showed specifically where the encroachments would occur.
Where the boundary was, so there was that discussion as well.
That is correct. And that is Mr. Carpenter's testimony, and that was on the first day of trial. Now the issue there is that these are large buildings that Village Center owns. Mr. Hibbert sold this property. He once owned the entire property. He understood where the property lines were. In between Mr. Hibbert's building now and the other buildings that my client owns is a corridor. And within that corridor, which Mr. Hibbert owns, Mr. Hibbert allowed my client to improve the sidewalks, to add snowmelt, to add landscaping.
He's not claiming any damages or trespass for those, is he?
He is claiming it for a trash enclosure, though, Your Honor.
Yeah, but that's not related to the other matters you just told us about.
I would argue that it is. I would argue that there was a determination by Mr. Hibbert that he would seek only trespass as to work on the exteriors of my client's buildings and as to a trash enclosure, which was also outside my client's property line. As part of that, Your Honors, I would argue that the issue on appeal is not the remedies, but it is the issue of permission. And after 2004, and before that time, there was no objection to any of the particular work that was being done during the day by a contractor. And at the same time, there was one objection by Mr. Hibbert as to work through that corridor on a driveway. My client had proposed to build an additional structure that would actually be on Mr. Hibbert's property. Now you have to understand that these are in very close proximity to each other, this property. It was a separated property. However, Mr. Hibbert rejected this proposed work on my client, and as a result, that work never occurred. So, Your Honors, I would ask that you affirm the judgment on trespass. At this juncture, my client completed the construction of a permanent improvement that has a slight encroachment on Mr. Hibbert's property.
And what is that encroachment specifically? It's the trash bin or trash enclosure?
It's a type of rock fascia around a trash enclosure at the front of the party's properties. And in addition to that, my client constructed on its buildings an additional amount of like lobby space, as I understand it. And so these are small encroachments. And so once my clients step out of their building, they're immediately in the corridor that is owned by Mr. Hibbert.
Was there some issue with overhanging eaves constituting an encroachment?
Yes, that is correct. That is part of, basically what happened was the buildings were pushed out during this renovation project.
Who takes the risk of a mistake as far as, or a misunderstanding as far as boundaries? If you wanted to build something thinking that it was your property, but it ultimately ends up someone else's property, is that permission because there was no objection?
If I understand your question correctly, Your Honor, if a party is aware and has full knowledge.
No.
What's your question?
Here's the question. You want to build on your property thinking there's a boundary line somewhere. You build on the property and it encroaches on the other property. You didn't mean to, but it does. Now the other party says, wait, it encroaches on my property. And it is a response, you never objected to it. It should be okay. I should have permission.
No, there's a duty to investigate on behalf of both parties, Your Honor.
Then I think back to my original question. Did anybody inform Mr. Hibbert, hey, our work is going to be on your property. Any problem?
Yes, Your Honor, that did occur.
Okay.
And I would refer you to the testimony of Mr. Carter. And I would also refer you to the exhibits that are actually referenced in the judgment that address the discussions that were occurring with Mr. Hibbert concerning the improvement project, Your Honor.
Thank you. Thank you, counsel.
As to the contract claim, our position is that the second supplement does control. At this juncture, it describes that my client is responsible for maintenance of the parking area.
Counsel, let me ask you about this, because in your complaint, it's presented as you were overbilled under all three of the operative documents. In your trial brief, again, you weren't contesting that the other two weren't valid. How did it all of a sudden change after trial to the second supplement being the only valid contract?
It basically came to the point where, prior to our investigation of this case, it was difficult to discern what in fact the arrangement was. And the problem was that the declarant was denying that any of them on its own apply. So basically this case required trial so that we could develop exactly what the contract was and why it applied. So I would say that leading up to the trial, and then the actual trial testimony indicates that the septic supplement control. That was my client's understanding of the arrangement, and it appeared that that was the document that superseded both the original declaration and the first supplement.
But you would agree that's a legal question?
I would agree that whether it's the contract, yes, that is a legal question.
And Exhibit U at trial was something that Mr. Hibbert sent to your prior counsel, setting forth how they were billing the expenses. At that point, it was under 32 in the first original and the first supplement, the original declaration and first supplement. I didn't see any contention at that point in time, but that wasn't correct by the association. They didn't seem to object to that.
No, I don't think there was any objection by the association until 2011. Again, I would argue that the second supplement does control. It defines it as maintenance of the parking area. Maintenance being a common word, support, upkeep of a particular area, namely the parking area.
Musselman.
Right? Yes.
What about the provision in 6B that except as is otherwise provided by the provisions of each supplement to this declaration, all of the provisions in the declaration shall be applicable to the condominium units submitted by this second supplement. That seems to me to say that this is a supplement. We're supplementing what we did previously, and we're leaving alone what we did previously, but we're adding to it. How do you respond to that?
I would say that in certain provisions in those declarations that the second supplement could add to other provisions that were in either the first or in the declaration. However, my position is that paragraph 6 completely superseded those earlier provisions by limiting the payments that were required by my client to maintenance of the parking area. And I think that was a function of the evolution of this particular project.
So is it the association's contention that they're not responsible for any repair, any insurance, any taxes? They're not responsible for any of that, any proportionate share?
Well, I would say as for repairs, that would fall under maintenance. But that is the big ticket issue, whether something falls into maintenance, meaning upkeep or support, or whether it's an improvement. Our position is that we as an association should not be paying for example, work on a roof on a completely other side of the building that has nothing to do with the parking garage. So I think it's not just the term maintenance, it's actually the specific area. So I would say if it was a repair, that would likely fall under maintenance.
But maintenance and repair are used separately in the declaration, which suggests they have different meanings.
In the original declaration, is that
and
correct?
The first supplement. Correct. So if we were hypothetically to agree with Mr. Hibbert's interpretation that there should be treated differently, how does that comport with your interpretation?
I would argue that the term maintenance is a broad word, and that encompasses maintenance. And I think the most important portion is that of the parking area, that we are responsible for maintaining, supporting, and keeping the status quo of that particular parking area. Regardless of whether the court finds here that an earlier declaration controls or modifies the second supplement. Additionally, there was a third issue as to this appeal, and that's costs. And if this court does affirm the judgment of the trial court, we would request our costs be affirmed, namely because it's 0.7% of the amount that was sought by the defendant, Mr. Hibbert, at trial. This was a two-day trial. The costs were low, given the amount of issues that were disputed by the parties. And just to go back to the contract before I close, with respect to damages, the bookkeeper for my client did testify at trial, and given the review of the invoices that he performed starting basically in 2011, he extrapolated from that the costs for each parking space that my client actually paid directly for maintenance. And so as a result of that, he was able to establish how much per parking space Village Center should pay. The trial court did require an accounting. That accounting was performed after the parties provided briefs on the accounting and additional documentation. The judge did determine that an accounting would not change basically the determination that he had previously made, that there were $14,500 in damages. Unless you have any questions for me, I'll sit down. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
Your Honors, with respect to the interpretation of the second supplement, the court found that the parties specifically intended to change the declaration, but overlooked the fact that Mr. Hibbard was the declarant. There were not parties to this agreement. This was Mr. Hibbard as the declarant setting forth in a document how this was going to go forward. And I think the court maybe misunderstood what was trying to be achieved there. I also disagree that the record has testimony from Mr. Schnupp that he extrapolated information relating to maintenance. He simply took the bills and divided by 47 for each year, come up with a per parking space cost. I'd like to also address the issue of trespass. The only testimony in the record regarding the showing of this proposed encroachment was Mr. Carpenter saying that he pulled out plans, put them on the back of his car, and showed Mr. Hibbard. Now, Mr. Hibbard denied that he gave any consent, and those plans were never introduced at trial. They simply were not an exhibit for anybody to look at and say, this shows what the area of the encroachment is.
Didn't Mr. Carpenter indicate in his testimony, however, that the boundary lines were on the plans for Mr. Hibbard to see?
I don't know if he specifically said the boundary lines were there. What we did have was testimony from the architect who testified that he told Mr. Carpenter these buildings encroach over the boundary. And Mr. Carpenter said words to the effect that it's okay. There's no writing, there's no letter, there's no email regarding these encroachments. In fact, Mr. Hibbard's testimony was that he was not aware of the extent and the existence of the encroachment until the association came to him before filing this action and asked for an easement. And he refused to give the easement. And that easement showed the extent of the encroachment, and the testimony was that there was no survey ever prepared by the association to show the extent of the encroachment.
Does it have to be a milling permission? Does, you know, when Mr. Hibbard said, yeah, that looks good, that's fine, go right ahead. Does he have to have known go right ahead would be on my property?
I believe to give consent, you have to know. There was no evidence that this was reckless consent. He had, in the letters leading up to this renovation, specifically told the association, don't build that, it's going to come on my property. And the association, in correspondence, had indicated that it would honor his request and not come onto his property. And the only testimony in the record was from Mr. Hodfeld, the surveyor, who had done work on this building before, introduced an improvement location certificate that showed that the property did not encroach before the renovation, and then showed that it encroached after the renovation. And the only testimony of value was with respect to that continuing encroachment. And the court also didn't address what happens, or may an owner withdraw consent if given, and what happens under those circumstances. Does it become a continuing trespass if consent is withdrawn? The court did not address that.
Judge, go ahead.
No, go ahead, Judge.
But if your client testified, as I understand the record he did, there was no consent, how can you then withdraw something that never happened?
He's saying, look, Judge, I don't mean to be that informal, but if you find that I gave consent, I'm going to withdraw consent. We know that the encroachment exists. So if you are saying that I gave consent, I'm now withdrawing that consent, and it becomes a continuing trespass.
Now, let me ask you about that. How realistic is it to say, I give my consent, go right ahead and build it, whatever investment you make, I withdraw my consent. All those millions or whatever you invested in it, too bad for you. How shouldn't there be something that ought to stop someone from withdrawing their consent?
If in fact he knew. But here we have Mr. Carpenter testifying to a $10 million renovation to turn this project into a world-class resort, and he doesn't do a survey to go to the owner and say, this is what I'm doing.
But it's back to, was it really consent, as I take it? Not can you withdraw consent, but I never gave consent.
That's, under the circumstances of this case, that's more likely true than not. You can't allow a building to be built and then say, take it down. That's not realistic. But there's nothing that the court did to recognize the value obtained by the association in encroaching on Mr. Hibbard's and not compensating him at all for that.
Thank you, counsel.
I have one more question also. I'm looking at the transcript of Mr. Carpenter's testimony, and Mr. Musselman was questioning him, and he asked him, did the plans on the hood of the car show the property line? And the witness says, yes, sir, it did. And Mr. Musselman says, and then the building was built according to the plans without deviation. That's correct. And then there was some issue about, do you have these plans with you? Can you bring them in later? And you said, I think you said, that those plans were never introduced into evidence.
They were never introduced.
That the plans that were on the hood of the car were not introduced into evidence.
That's correct.
Okay. Thank you. And based upon those few questions that we had of Mr. Porterfield, right?
Correct.
Mr. Porterfield, Mr. Musselman, do you want to make any comments based upon those few questions that we had after Mr. Porterfield's time had expired?
Actually, one comment, if the goal permit. One of the findings that the court made, the trial court made on trespass, was a finding of waiver and estoppel. And the question by Judge Daly related to whether or not the consent was actually given or not, I believe falls into Judge Granger's determination about waiver, meaning that Mr. Hibbard had information at the time. Mr. Hibbard understood and knew that the work was occurring at a particular time, and Mr. Hibbard did nothing and stood idly by when he did have an opportunity to object, and did in fact object to other work that was done in this exact same particular area, a very small corridor and on three separate buildings.
There could be an inference that he objected because he knew that that was going to encroach upon his property, or he may not have objected because he didn't know about an encroachment on this other building.
That's a potential inference, yes, Your Honor. I would argue that based upon the testimony of Mr. Carpenter, that Mr. Hibbard knew full well where the property line was and what occurred and what was looked at on the back of Mr. Hibbard's car before he left for a holiday. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. And thank you both for your excellent arguments this afternoon. Those arguments are going to be very helpful to the court and rendering an opinion. This matter will stand submitted to the court, and an opinion will issue in due course.